Welcome to the Agile Book Club podcast, where we hang out and talk shop with the authors whose ideas are shaping the agile landscape. Here is your host, Paul Klipp.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Agile Book Club podcast. Today, I'll be sharing with you the second half of my interview with Sumeet Moghe, the author of the Async First Playbook, Remote Collaboration Techniques for Agile Software Teams. I'm going to keep this really short because I'm sick and I feel miserable and I don't know how long I can keep my voice together. So please pardon me for the brevity of this introduction. Those of you who have been listening to the podcast will have listened to the first half of this interview 2 weeks ago. What we're going to do today is a deeper dive into some of the specific topics that I really wanted to explore for you, and I hope you enjoy it. All right. And so, now hopping into the second half of the interview, I want to pick up where we left off at the end of the first half of the interview, which is that asynchronous work allows us to create time for deep work. And it sounds nice. The idea that we have less meetings and that the meetings that we do have are shorter and more impactful is wonderful. But in a complex environment in which a team is not just responsible only to the other seven people on their team, but is in an environment in which there are lots of demands placed on them from outside, from HR, mandatory training, town halls, leadership meetings, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What is to keep the organization from sucking up all of the free time that they create by pulling them into new meetings? Oh, I see you have a lot of time. Come and help us with this.
Yeah, and that's where leadership comes in. So we've tried this a few experiments to insulate our team a little bit. This is on the teams that I've worked. Where, look, if you've got free time on your calendar, somebody's going to take it away, right? And I'm not saying that those are for bad reasons. You might be needed for an interview, or somebody will say, hey, can you run this training session for us, or can you appear in front of a client for us? Because again, we're a consulting firm, so appearing in front of clients is our bread and butter. But if you decide that, well, you want to work asynchronously, you've got to figure out what your inviolate hours are and what your meeting hours are. So what we've done on some of the teams that we've worked on, and I mentioned this briefly in the book as well, is that you start to look at your week as an inverted L. Wherein the first half, for example, of every day is meeting free. And if you can give yourself a bonus, make Fridays meeting free. Now, making it meeting free means you block your calendar and do focus time or whatever your calendaring application gives you to indicate and signal to everyone else that, well, you're blocked, right? And so that signals not just to your teammates, but also to everyone else in the organization that you're not available. That still leaves a very generous 16 hours every week for meetings. But what it does, it protects 24 hours for deep work. And I found that that works wonderfully because, well, now inside the team, you're not creating any meetings. The only meetings that you're allowing yourself to have are not really meetings, they're pair programming. And then if you want to do, let's say you decide, well, we absolutely need this catch up. Well, do it in that second half. You're also able to attack complex problems when your mind is freshest, which is early in the morning, which is the case for most people. I understand there are exceptions. And then, that bonus of having the whole Friday dedicated to deep work and no meetings also allows you to end your week with a sense of accomplishment. Imagine if it was the other way around, where you had five meetings in that Friday afternoon and you couldn't get anything done, you'd end your week feeling like, well, oh, I don't know, how did that week actually go? But if you were able to get, a story complete, or you were able to help out a colleague when pair programming with them, you end your week with a sense of accomplishment as well.
There's another point that you make in the book about this, which I like very much, because the impression that you're giving here is that that there's really only two options, meetings and deep work. But the distinction really is between meetings and agency. It's between having commitments and having the freedom to decide how to best use your time. And in that space, in that freedom, one might very well say, one might very well decide, what I really need to do is to focus for 4 hours on this big problem. But it also creates opportunities for collaboration, for emergency huddles, for supporting people who are in need, for dealing with emergencies that are arising. And so I think the way that you make the case in the book is that when people aren't in meetings all the time, problems get solved faster. People are available sooner for these things that come up. And so, yes, it's not just meetings and focus work. It's meetings and trusting human beings to make the best use of their time and having time in which to make the decisions about what they're doing. So, but you're absolutely right. It all comes down to leadership, because it's the leaders. It's the leaders, the ones with the power, who are the ones who come in and say, you know, I know that Fridays are no meeting days, but this is really important. And it's important because I'm important.
Yeah. And by the way, the point that you just mentioned, I say that pretty early on in the book. My book's called The Async First Playbook, but it's not called The Async Only Playbook. And that's for a reason, because, well, meetings do have a place. For example, if you have a production outage, you don't want to go slowly writing a document about it. You'd like a few hands on deck to be able to get the problem solved, right? And there, the speed that you're able to get, the spontaneity you're able to get, the ability that you have to be able to address the moment is invaluable. So I don't have a problem with meetings per se. I have a problem with bad meetings and meetings punctuating our entire day and not leaving enough time for constructive, deep, complex work.
And that brings us to the model that you propose for evaluating your meetings. Could you describe the, and tell me if I'm pronouncing this correctly, the Convarel model? Yeah. and how it's used?
Yeah, you can pronounce it anyway. So really, for listeners, you've got to try and imagine this as two axes. And on the x-axis, on one side, you have convergence, where you're trying to get together and maybe make a decision together, right? And then you have conveyance, where you're only trying to give information to another party, right? And then on the y-axis, you have the strength of the relationship, right? So you either have a very strong relationship or you have a weak relationship. Now, typical MBA 2x2 matrix gets constructed with this. And now think about conveyance on a strong relationship. This is where status updates tend to fall, right? In general, you don't need meetings for that kind of thing, because all you're doing is getting information from point A to point B. You can do that via an email, text message, document, whatever works for you. An example of this is stand-up meetings. Stand-up meetings back in the day were necessary. We didn't have electronic card walls. We all used to work together in one place. The stand-up meetings, by the way, back in the day used to be standing up, right? So you would stand around a wall. So your meetings by definition just became very short, your stand-up meetings. But now if you try to do the same thing online, I've noticed that stand-up meetings, because you're sitting down, can be even 45 minutes. And they become a teeth-pulling exercise because nobody knows whether it's their turn to speak or whether it's the other person's turn to speak. So oftentimes you have a project manager sitting there saying, okay, now, Paul, give your update. Sumit, give your update. And you don't want that tooth-pulling exercise. You can do that much better by making your electronic card wall, whether it's Trello, Jira, Pivotal Tracker, Asana, whatever, as the single source of truth. You want an update on a task, it's there on that particular card itself, right? So, okay, I digress a little bit. So there's the convergence on a strong relationship bit. Now you can have, conveyance on a strong relationship. Now you can have conveyance on a weak relationship. Even in this case, you can share the information asynchronously, but you can use the meeting as a contrivance to build the relationship too, right? So you eventually want it to get there, but maybe you start building out the relationship by sharing information in a synchronous fashion. Then you come to convergence on a weak relationship. That's a no-brainer, right? You don't want to be making decisions with somebody you have a weak relationship with, trying to do this in writing over instant messaging or a document. You're probably going to go wrong there. And those are the best cases to organize meetings, make that contentious decision. And then if you have conveyance on a strong relationship, my suggestion is always to use a hybrid approach, which is start asynchronously. So let's take the situation where you were trying to make a decision. Get all of the information you need to be able to make that decision asynchronously. Let everyone consume that decision, reduce everyone's cognitive load a little bit, and then meet only to make that particular decision where you can hear everyone out, you get people's emotions to the fore, and you've now also got the highest quality decision because everyone studied the background information in their own time, right? So that's the way I look at it. And if you start triaging your meetings this way, you'll probably realize that you're being a little more pragmatic with which meetings you actually need.
It also is a really nice way of explaining the cost and time savings that come from strong relationships. When you have strong relationships, you can do so much, you have so much more flexibility. When I think of strong versus weak relationships, what I'm thinking, I'm not sure if it's the same as what you intended, is a function of trust, respect for capabilities, understanding of capabilities, and understanding of contexts. So I know what you're capable of, I know your context, I know what you need, and when I tell you the information I think you need, you trust that it's correct, and you're unlikely to need a lot of support or validation
exactly.
or verification.
And that's exactly the way I think of it.
And when you have those that trust, yeah, you don't need to meet nearly so often. So I want to talk about tools, because you talk a lot about tools. There are a lot of tools that are now available. In the last interview, you mentioned that one of the constraints is that managers are not exposed to these tools. And from a tools standpoint, my question is, is it better to find the best tool for each type of communication at the risk of having the right information scattered across many tools? Or is it better to accept compromises and have a minimal tool set for sharing and storing?
Yeah, and I think most organizations have answered that question very well already, because the pandemic forced them to invest in a tool set that works for them. Because if you notice, most organizations have signed up to an ecosystem of tools. So you will see people are on SharePoint plus Teams plus Office 365, or they are on Zoom plus Confluence plus Jira, right? And what they've done, in effect, is they've chosen tools that may not be best in class, but they tend to work well with each other, right? And they've also chosen tools for the fact that they have the right vendor relationships and things like that. And I feel that shopping around for the best tool all the time is counterproductive, because there's a diminishing law of returns that comes into play from that point on. It's the ubiquity of that tool in your company environment that is far more valuable than how good that tool is or how elegantly it does something. So sure, Zoom might do a few things better than Teams, but if your company is already using Teams, do you really need to go and now start getting a Zoom license for your team? I don't think so, because what it'll do is when you start to have interactions with people outside your team, you're going to have to use a completely different tool set. And switching tools has a load, has a cognitive load that you need to keep dealing with, right? And you'd rather get proficient with one set of tools and know their limitations than, you know, this tool in this context and that tool in that context. And, well, you're never going to get the most efficient possible that way.
One of the things, and I forget exactly how you say it, but one of the things that points that you make in the book that I think is important to understand is that accepting asynchronous work is also accepting that decision and communication take time. The communication becomes a process rather than an event. And one of the things that comes to mind is, especially in a low psychological safety environment, one of the benefits of asynchronous communication is that people have time to think about complex decisions. They have time to think through their ideas and other people's ideas, and time to think about how they want to express their own ideas. But doesn't that also run the risk of the bike shed phenomenon, in which people are discussing online indefinitely about a decision that could be taken in moments in a meeting? How do you manage that?
Absolutely. And there are some ground rules that we need to have in place. Like, for example, one of the things I talk about is consent-based decision making, right? Wherein, sure, we can do better, but do you have a show-stopping objection? And if you don't, then we still go ahead, right? And we get to the point of accepting good enough, because we don't want perfect to be the enemy of good enough, right? So some of those ground rules, I've noticed that teams want to believe them implicitly, but they don't want to codify them. And one of the things I've actually recommended in the book, and also generally practice on my teams, is that if you have a way of working, now, for example, decision making is an example that you pointed out, write up the process and write up the sentiment behind it. That helps two things. One, it makes it crystal clear to everyone on the team as to how you're going to be approaching decision making. But the good thing is that it also becomes an onboarding artifact for anyone else who's going to join the team, so that they know how you are going to make decisions and they don't get into, for example, the bike shedding phenomenon that we're talking about. So yes, there is that pitfall, but you keep yourself honest. And then what are you also measuring yourself on? One of the things that an async first team should be measuring itself on is decision velocity. How many decisions are you getting through the door? Because if your decision velocity is not improving, then you're not getting one of the big benefits of being asynchronous.
I like that. How do you measure decision velocity?
So there are a couple of, these can be rather shallow. So you need to start looking at them in context with other factors as well. But for example, how many architectural decision records are you logging? How many business decision records are you logging? How many idea papers are you discussing? Those are good ways to be able to measure your activity on decisions. And you can start tracking these sprint on sprint, because you're probably making architectural decisions every sprint. You just don't think of them as big enough, and hence you've not been documenting them. But you and I have been in the industry long enough that we've encountered this situation on every single project, where somebody comes in 3 months down the line and says, why is this a certain way? And everyone's put their hands up in the air saying, I don't know, because nobody documented it, right? And it's those micro decisions that you document, and you say, I'm taking this call and I'm going ahead because I think it's reversible, and I'm documenting the rationale behind it, right? And so if you can start documenting those, that'll give you a metric to say, how many decisions are we making sprint on sprint?
I love that. So a synchronous only team, a team that spends all of their time in meetings, doesn't really have a baseline for their decision throughput, because decisions are so ad hoc and are quickly forgotten. But the moment you move to an async first approach, you start to get the records that you need in order to track the pace of your decisions, and you can look for improvement there. Love it. Love it. Which brings us to defaulting to action, which is very close to this. And that also requires a lot of safety. What can leaders do in an environment where people don't feel comfortable taking risks because they've never had to make decisions by themselves before? They could always bring it up in a stand-up or bring it up in a planning session. And now you're expecting them to take decisions. And you might document the rules for taking decisions, like this kind of decision is reversible and can safely be taken by an individual. But you still have to deal with the culture, a culture in which being wrong is uncomfortable and potentially dangerous. What can leaders do to help people feel comfortable defaulting to action?
Yeah, and this is where the overused cliche of rolling up your sleeves, getting dirt under your fingernails comes into play, right? Wherein, if you are a leader, then you've got to be spending a little bit more time in the trenches. What does that mean? If you're a tech lead, then you've got to spend more time pairing, Because invariably, where is that point of decision going to come when somebody is working on code, for example? If you are a senior product manager, then you're going to have to spend more time building the next experiment, designing the next experiment, creating the next prototype, designing the next wireframe, right? That's when a decision-making trigger is going to come into play. And that's where you can start coaching people into saying, well, we don't need to get 15 people into a meeting to make this decision. Let's document it and go ahead. When they see you giving them confidence one-on-one to do this, that's when people will follow. And guess what? Not having 20 meetings every week on your calendar frees up time for you to lead this way in the trenches, for you to get that dirt under your fingernails, for you to be able to roll up your sleeves. And I feel that's the place where leaders need to spend more of their time. And I think there's great value in doing this because, look, I think we're fast getting to the point where a pure manager, somebody who comes in purely because they have leadership skills and no other skills, that kind of a manager is going to become defunct in a few years. You need people who come with some solid technical skills in a certain sphere, and they are able to actually go in and help the people that they manage accomplish a task, get over a challenge, finish, get over some complexity, whatever, right? And they're able to also lead and remove obstacles from people's way, take off pressure and deal with those kinds of things and do coaching and stuff like that. So I feel like the best thing leaders can do is get into the trenches with the people that they lead and coach them through the decision-making process and give them the confidence that, well, we don't need a meeting for this. Let's just document it and go ahead. And then that's how people will learn.
Speaking of documentation, this is one of the weak points, I think, or I should say challenges of asynchronous work, is that when you move to more asynchronous work, people, everyone has to read, and at least most people, if not everyone, has to write. And that takes time, and none of that is on the backlog. None of that is necessarily recognized by everyone, because a lot of the writing is for a limited audience. A lot of the reading is for a limited audience. And so how do you address the desire of an individual, the need of an individual to feel productive, while at the same time requiring them to do this work, which is, it is creating an artifact, but it's not an obvious, planned, visible value-adding artifact?
Yeah, so can I try and answer that in a more specific way than at a more generic level, right? So part of it is a bit of an honor system. Now, imagine that there are no meeting minutes, right? That's an artifact that comes out of a meeting. The reason why we do it is out of empathy for our teammates, that for them to consume the output of the meeting, it should be easy. They should be able to understand in 5 minutes what we did, let's say, over an hour. Now, the moment you don't do that, you create this sense where everyone's got the fear of missing out. And that is when everyone wants to start attending every meeting, right? So the honor system is that after you have gone through a meeting, you spend 5 minutes documenting it. You do the good turn to your teammates, they will do the good turn to you, and that'll free up time for you, right? In a similar way, let's think about another artifact. Let us say you have the process of code reviews. You document your pull request properly so that the person who's reviewing your code understands the kind of change that you're trying to make. What does this do? It saves the back and forth that'll happen in the code review process. And it'll probably ensure that your code gets merged quickly. And you will get a sense of accomplishment as a consequence. So you are, of course, spending a little bit of extra time than just sending across the code to somebody and saying, go review it. But you're giving yourself a better chance of that code getting merged quickly and for you to be able to move to the next task. And I can give you this example. For example, let's talk about an idea. You want to include a new library on your code base. Now, instead of me having to explain it to Paul and then having to explain it to Gayatri and then having to explain it to James and then call a meeting where I explain it to everyone else together, I can write it once, have everyone review it, drop their comments, address all the comments, and then just have one meeting where we make the decision on of whether to use the library or not. What I've done in effect, not only have I shown empathy for everyone, I've gotten myself a better chance of getting that library integrated into the code base. So to a certain extent, it's the investment that you make now for the payoff that will happen later. But it's also an honor system where you have a little bit of empathy for others. You save them the time, and then they save you the time when it's their turn.
Thank you. Yes, that makes perfect sense. It might seem a little ironic, but I want to wrap up a conversation about asynchronous working with meetings. And that is that, well, I think one of the things I really liked about this book is that you also talk about meetings. And it seems like a lot of the benefit of moving to an async first approach is that what meetings you have take on much greater significance. And there are three examples in particular that I want to touch on. One of them, of course, I love the idea that if the team is only coming together for stand-ups because they like to see each other and have some sort of a sense of connection with each other, do the stand-ups remotely and come together and talk about something completely different. Something interesting, like what's going on in your lives or what our health indicators are telling us or what have you. But another idea that I like very much is this idea that sometimes people need to come together to make a decision, but it doesn't have to be the whole team. So could you describe this concept in the book? And it's the first place I've ever seen it. I'm not sure if it's yours. Take credit if it is. The idea of pods within a team and directly responsible individuals.
Yeah, the directly responsible individuals, I think, comes from Amazon and then GitLab took it. And then I somehow gleaned from GitLab. But the idea of pods is something that we've practiced quite a bit in teams that we've run here. So the pods are short-lived. And the reason that they're short-lived, I'll come to in a bit, but you organize pods around features or capabilities that you're building, right? And you try to keep these pods small, which is 2 people, 3 people, maximum 4 people, because any more than that, you're creating a mini team that right there, right? Now, everyone has to trust the pod that they're making the decisions, the right decisions for that particular feature, right? Now, obviously, there will be times where members of the pod can't make a decision, can't come to a consensus about a decision, in which case you have somebody who's a first amongst equals in that group, who's the directly responsible individual who breaks the tie, right? And the reason why this works is because, well, beyond a certain size of group, right, there's a law of diminishing returns that comes into play with the number of people who keep adding their opinions about a decision. So if I have ownership to deliver a feature, I'm going to do my damnedest best to take the right decisions, because eventually all the decisions are getting logged with my name on it, right? So I don't want to have a bad reputation on the team. And of course, there are other people out there in the pod who keep me honest. But the trick here is to keep these pods short-lived. And the reason why you want to keep these pods short-lived is if you don't keep them short-lived, you create knowledge silos where only a certain group of people know about a certain capability in the system. So you can say, well, for the next month and a half, this feature is going to get owned by these 3 people, right? And this person's the directly responsible individual. And then after a while, you rotate individuals across pods if that feature takes long to develop. Hopefully, nothing should take more than a month and a half to get at least the bare minimum functionality out. If it's taking you any longer, then you're not slicing your functionality well enough, and that's a different problem to solve. But that's been our experience, that you work in short-lived pods and keep them small. 3 is ideal. 4 is probably the maximum that you should have in that.
Well, what I liked about it is oftentimes I will see when a person is stuck in a team, they take the problem to the team. And so if you've got a team of 12 people and one engineer is stuck, they take the problem to 11 people and they have to describe the context to most of them. And the concept of a pod around a specific piece of functionality gives them formal permission to discuss their problem with just 1 or 2 people instead of 12 who already understand their context.
Exactly. And that reduces the cognitive load considerably. The other thing which you will probably know from your experience as well, even if you take it to 12 people, let us say back in the day in an office setting, you were huddled around a whiteboard. It is still just four or five people who are conveying their thoughts. The rest of the people are just participating very passively. So in effect, you're not getting any more input. You just have that sense of security that 11 people took a look at it, but 11 people really didn't participate in the decision. So you might as well keep the blast radius small, but you want to be transparent at the same time. And that's one of the things I mentioned, that you still want to be transparent in the way you document your decisions. And if the decision is going to affect others, then you communicate that as widely as possible and probably have a due by date before by which everyone should respond, so that you don't have inadvertent consequences for the decision, right? And those are calls that you can take inside the pod. But for the most part, you want to reduce the blast radius of your communication.
Love it. My last question, also about meetings, and this is one close to my heart. I just recently gave a conference talk about the subject of better one-on-ones, because I see this as a fundamental and painful problem in line management in corporations, is the inadequacy of both the quality and the consistency of one-on-ones. And you make a lovely case that if you reduce the number of meetings that you have, you can do more of the important meetings. And one of the meetings that you argue is very important is the one-on-one. And in most of the places where I've been, one-on-ones happen at best every 2 weeks. And when they do get canceled because of illness or a holiday, they don't get rescheduled. They just happen a month later. They're not prioritized. Could you make the case? So you've got a manager who's read the book, implemented the ideas, suddenly they have a lot of space in their calendars. Make the case for using that time to improve your one-on-ones.
Well, I would first say, as a manager, what is it that you're wanting from the people that work for you? You want them to be able to perform well, and you want to be able to have yourself recognized as the leader of a high-performing team. And if you had to do that, then one of the ways of reimagining your role is reimagining yourself as a coach to a certain extent, right? And oftentimes, that one-on-one space is your opportunity to do a lot of the coaching, where you get to practice radical candor. You can give people feedback and confidence. You get to build a personal relationship with them. You get to understand what they're doing, how far they've gotten vis-a-vis their goals, and where the gaps might be. And, you know, the safety that you're able to create in a one-on-one setting versus a group setting, there's just no parallel. I mean, the fact that you get to know a person intimately through these one-on-ones, and you can care personally but still challenge directly, I think is a killer feature for any leader. Now, the other thing to actually ensure that you are able to make this work is to not oversubscribe yourself. And one of the things that we don't do enough is push back as leaders, right? So oftentimes you'll be saddled with 10 people who are directly reporting to you, right? And it takes a special kind of person to be able to manage 10 people. In my experience, anything more than 5 is just too many people, right? And the reason for that is, if you're doing one one-on-one every day, then that's all of your 5 days of the week gone. And you need to do work in addition to that, right? You'll have your one-on-ones. Those one-on-ones are probably going to result in actions for you as well, which you're going to have to take after the meeting. Plus, you have your day job to take care of. So any more than 5 is probably too many. If you don't have experience as a manager, you should be pushing back and saying, I can't handle any more direct reports. And then you'll probably do more justice to people who are reporting into you and who are depending on you for their professional success.
So thank you so much for joining us for this episode of the podcast. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Sumeet as much as I enjoyed it. I hope you got some good ideas. I think that there's a lot of value, especially in these times of remote work, in asynchronous work. One of the things that I feel very strongly about is that nobody is paid to be in a meeting all the time. Not even facilitators are paid to be in meetings all the time. We need time to think. And some of the problems that we're dealing with are big and hairy, and they can't be solved by people in stand-ups. They have to be solved by people thinking carefully and deeply at a time of their choosing when they're in the right mindset to think. And so asynchronous work gives us that opportunity to do the work the way it needs to be done, the way we as professionals know it ought to be done, rather than on someone else's schedule in our calendar. So I hope you'll take this message to heart and find more humane ways to be productive at work. So this will be the last episode of the year. It's been absolutely wonderful making these podcasts for you. I hope you enjoy them. This is the time of year when many, many of our listeners are celebrating various holidays around the world. So I want to wish those of you who are celebrating a happy holiday season. And I've got a special surprise for you in the new year. Okay, not such a special surprise. It's a podcast. Who knew? Of course it's a podcast. But to celebrate a day on which many people start to make plans to improve their life, those of you who believe in resolutions, but also those of you who just believe that it's a good time for reflection, I've got a really fun book to talk about. And if you want to read ahead, you can get your copy now. If you have Kindle Unlimited, it's free right now. And that is the book, Build Your Way, Applying Product Management to Life. So this is a book by an author who I met when he was a speaker at the ACE conference last year. There's a little free plug for the conference. His name is Miloš Belcevic. And he's a lovely man. He's a very, very talented and experienced product manager and product coach. But what he does in this book is he takes the ideas of product management and applies them to crafting a better life for ourselves. I thought that was a lovely way to overlap two very important different themes, and one of them is continuous improvement, which of course is something that we as agilists and product people hold dear to our hearts. And the other one is learning product management. There are a lot of people who want to learn product management techniques, perhaps to break into a product management career, or perhaps to expand their toolkit. And one of the challenges that such people have is finding opportunities to actually put those tools, techniques, and thinking to practice. And so what better place to practice than on yourself? So get the book, give it a read, listen to the podcast when I talk to the author on the 1st and 15th of January next year. Bring in the new year on a good note with me and my guest, Miloš Belcevic. Until then, happy year's end and happy holidays to all of you. From the Agile Book Club podcast and the ACE conference, goodbye.